Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium and the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. Hello, everybody.
So election day this November, Sam, created quite a stir in the world of politics. The victory of Democrats in the New Jersey and Virginia gubernatorial races gave Democrats the first feeling, I'd say, in a while that there really are some serious political vulnerabilities in the president's armor, and that the Republicans might be paying a price or will pay a price for some of what's happened in the White House across the country. There are also mayoral races and referenda that suggested Democrats might be regaining some of their footing. And for all the talk about winning over Trump voters that we've heard about since November, there was evidence here that a different kind of coalition was actually forming behind the Democrats that included suburban voters, millennials, women, African American, all the voters who have been turned off in many ways by what the president has stood for. So to discuss what happened in the election and just as important, the bigger implications for the year ahead, we have two fantastic people with us from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. We have Larry Sabato, who is a best-selling author. He appears regularly on many television stations, including my favorite CNN, where we often have appeared on panels together. He's the editor and author of Trumped, a book about the election. And of course, he heads Sabato's Crystal Ball, which has been recognized by the Pew Charitable Trust as the number one leader in the field of prediction, political prediction. He's been a really important and helpful voice in guiding us all through the different elections. And we also have his colleague, Jeffrey Skelly, media relations coordinator for the University of Virginia Center of Politics and the associate editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball, the nonpartisan newsletter that many of us like to read about campaigns and elections. He's been cited frequently on many publications, The Times, Newsweek, Politico, Huffington Post, and more. So we have two great people, Sam, joining us today, and I'd like to welcome them to our show.
Thank you for having us. We're looking forward to it.
So maybe Larry, we can start with you and tell us your thoughts about what happened in Virginia. We obviously know the outcome, but from all the polling and the data that we now have from the election, what happened in the gubernatorial race, and what explains the Democratic victory?
Well, first, the background, of course, is the demographic change that has transformed Virginia, and that's been going on for decades. It accelerated in the first decade of this new century, and it continues apace, and I suspect very soon people will no longer be coloring Virginia purple, but blue. We already do that. We have a light blue. It's not a California dark blue or New Jersey or New York dark blue, but it's a light blue. I don't think the changes are reversible, and they will continue pretty much along the lines we've seen. But that's the background. At the heart of this, and it's really important not to miss it, is a strong rebuke to President Trump and also a repudiation of the issues and tactics of Trumpism. And I think this is indicated in a number of ways, both in terms of polling data and even casual comments that people make at the polls and that all the news media covered in and around Election Day. Trump was never popular here. He lost by a little over 5 points to Hillary Clinton. Virginia was the only southern state she carried. But at the same time, you have to say that she didn't win by nearly as much as she was expected to here. In the private tracking, she had been leading by low double digits, somewhere between 9 and 12 points. So just like everybody everywhere else, the Trump vote turned out in larger numbers than expected. This turned out to be the opposite of 2016. One reason why all the media and the campaigns were convinced that this was a very close race. For example, Northam's private tracking said him ahead only 3. They were very concerned. was because the pollsters changed their weighting for the likely turnout, because the Democrats simply did not show up in the expected numbers in the 2016 presidential election. This being a gubernatorial election, with turnout falling dramatically from the 70s into the 40s of at least registered voters, they wondered whether minorities and millennials and other Democratic groups would really show up. Well, they not only showed up, they showed up in, for a gubernatorial election, record numbers, at least in modern times. And that's what propelled Ralph Northam, who's a low-key candidate. He's a wonderful guy. He's a straight arrow. He's a doctor. He's exactly what you see. He'll never stir a crowd. That's not his forte. And as a result, you have to attribute the enthusiasm to the anti-Trump intensity of opinion among Democrats. And people were rushing to the polls and saying, I want to send a message to Donald Trump. There were quite a few people at the polls, the press reported this, who had no idea who the Democratic nominee was, but they were there to vote against Trump. And that also affected our House of Delegates races. Jeff can talk about that. Jeff is an expert in all this and works in it on a daily basis and is a wonderful colleague. But nobody, and I mean nobody in either party, even the most optimistic Democrat, thought that Democrats could possibly gain more than 5 or 6 seats. The governor, Governor McAuliffe himself, a Democrat, told me that he would be thrilled if it were 8, but he thought it would be 4 to 6. And instead, the Democrats went from 34 seats, near their all-time low, to possibly 50-50. It could be 49, could be 51, could be 50. We're still waiting. We got 4 recounts that will determine. But regardless of where it turns out, it's stunning. This is under lines drawn by the Republicans to guarantee Republican elections, and they've done precisely that until November of this year.
Right, and I think we should interject here that at the level of the House of Delegates, it is certainly true that it was a bit of a stunning result that Democrats got up to, as you say, 49 or 50 out of 100 seats. But it should also be said that they that down ticket, they won at the ballot. Those down ticket candidates won by 9 percentage points again, about 9 percentage points, comparable to Northam's victory over Gillespie. So there is a lot to talk about there. Let me just back up and talk about the polling a little bit. So it strikes me that some of this could, not to get kind of, I'll offer a boring possibility, which is that a polling error in an odd-numbered year in between a 3-point Northam win and a 9-point actual, so a 3-point polling margin and a 9-point actual win, seems to me that how bad is that compared with other Virginia polling errors? It seems like it might be par for the course. Talk about that a little bit.
Jeff,
at least in recent off-year elections in Virginia, you know, whether you're talking about most recently the 2014 U.S. Senate race between Mark Warner and Ed Gillespie, and then in 2013, the gubernatorial race between Ken Cuccinelli and Terry McAuliffe, we saw something similar. But instead, the shift was in the Republican direction. And so you wonder if this is just a sign that what can happen in a lower turnout election, you know,
voter intensity.
Yeah, exactly. That voter intensity might matter more,
right?
Just because fewer people are likely to show up.
I see.
Who are most likely to show up are going to be the people who are most unhappy with the status quo. And
so,
we've also,
yeah,
even if you dig further back, you can see this as well in 2005, for example, in 2009. There's been something of a pattern to this in Virginia elections.
So this happens also in wave elections where polling margins look like they're at a certain point, and then there's just this break that happens. Like in the 2014 wave election for the Republicans, things at the very last minute seemed to break in the closing weeks of the election. There, that measured in weeks or maybe 1 week, seemed to be a big shift in at the 11th hour towards the Republicans, where they were the party out of office, at least at the level of the presidency. And there was a lot of voter enthusiasm, the kind of thing that Larry is talking about, where there's just this animal energy on one side really wanting the incumbent out. The incumbent party.
I think exactly right, yeah. Sam. The intensity changed parties. McAuliffe, I believe in the polling average right on election eve, he was up about 9. and he talks about this a lot. He was very disappointed to win by 2.5, and it affected his term. It made it much more difficult for him to get things done. It held the Republican margin in the General Assembly or in the House of Delegates to an enormous Republican edge, and he attributed it, frankly, and at least in private, to President Obama's unpopularity in Virginia. And it was true at that time, even though President Obama had carried Virginia twice, he was unpopular, and the energy was on the Republican side. They wanted to send a message to President Obama, and they really didn't. They didn't like either candidate particularly, and that's why the Libertarian candidate got about 7%. This Libertarian got, I believe, under 2% or around 2% this year. But intensity really matters in these off-year races, and I have to go back to 2008 in a presidential year for Obama to find Democrats this excited, except in 2008 it was a positive excitement. It was less about sending a message to George W. Bush, who was going out of office anyway, and more a message of enthusiasm for Barack Obama. Well, this is a very different kind of situation. Democrats here have been in a funk, as Democrats have around the country, since last November 8th, very depressed, very unhappy, almost daily with the things that President Trump is doing. And as a consequence, they were just determined to make certain that every Democrat won. And you're right, they voted Democrat, as we used to say in the South, from the White House to the courthouse. In this case, from the governor's mansion to the courthouse. There were Democratic upsets all over the place for small local positions. So, you know, that is a wave. That's a wave, and it's a party vote, and fits right in with what our friend Alan Abramowitz calls negative partisanship. People were determined to send the Republicans a message. They may not have been always excited about their party or the party's candidates, but they certainly preferred them by a mile over the Republican candidates.
Yeah, I've always thought that the intensity of feeling toward President Trump among Democrats is so strong that that is probably going to be the most powerful message going into the midterms, meaning voting against him more than any economic platform they can come up with. And this seemed to provide a little evidence about that. But on the other hand, I read Ron Brownstein had written something about how some of the Trump coalition, meaning voters in rural areas, in exurbs, or older voters, still held firm for the Republicans. Is that what you were seeing in Virginia? Did Democrats make any dent in those Trump areas, or is this purely about turnout in the Democratic areas?
I would say that it's mostly about turnout in the Democratic areas. Now, I will say that it's pretty clear that Gillespie didn't hold Trump's margins in some parts of the state, such as Southwest Virginia. Northam generally did slightly better than Clinton in the two-party vote almost everywhere, and thus Gillespie did slightly worse than Trump in most spots. But if you look sort of at a map of Virginia, the reddest areas, particularly in the southwest part of the state, Gillespie was able to win by very large margins, but wasn't quite able to replicate Trump's margins. But that still suggests that, on the whole, Democrats weren't exactly making inroads. And another thing to keep in mind when thinking about the House of Delegates, you know, Democrats look like they're going to get, you know, 14 or 15 seats net, and, you know, possibly, or I guess 15 or 16, excuse me, and possibly tie the House. But almost all of those seats were in areas that Hillary Clinton carried.
Right.
And so to some degree, What I think you have to look at it with some caution, thinking about 2018, is like Democrats were able to win in these suburban and exurban areas that Hillary Clinton carried, where Donald Trump was very unpopular, particularly in the three major metropolitan areas of Virginia. But they only won one seat that Donald Trump carried, and it was the one he carried by the smallest margin in Virginia, a little less than a point. So I think to some degree the result is good news for Democrats thinking about 2018, because there are a bunch more seats like this. You know, seats where Clinton carried them by margin, you know, by some margin, a small margin in suburbs, especially around major metropolitan areas, and maybe they can win those. But in terms of making inroads in areas that Trump carried, I don't think there's that much evidence to draw here. Though I will say the open seats, there were a couple open seats the Democrats almost won, and unless recounts really go their way, are going to probably be held by Republicans, where they did make great progress. And we've seen that in recent cycles where open seats, even if they have a, you know, a bit of a Republican lean or a Democratic lean, depending on the, you know, midterm situation, who's in the White House, you can see the out of White House party do a whole lot better and actually be in a position to potentially win. So I think the open seats are something to really keep in mind, given the number of retirements that have popped up, especially in the last few days, there's been some more.
Well, let me just rain on the Democrats' parade just a little bit more, and then I want to actually turn to national elections. In your own piece, Jeff, Signs and Portents, that you wrote, you and Kyle Condit wrote a week beforehand, you pointed out that the median performance in the two-party vote share typically is 7 points better than the presidential party performance the year before in Virginia. And so for Northam to do 4 points better than Hillary Clinton, which is what happened last week, seems to me to be kind of par for the course. The other thing that appears to be the case to me is that for the Democrats to win down ticket popular vote by 9 percentage points and yet still achieve a bare tie in the House of Delegates, to me, speaks to the degree of aggressive gerrymandering and reasonably successful gerrymandering that the majority, that the Republican majority that drew the lines was able to achieve. So at some level, this is, you know, in the face of this Democratic wave, it's an impressive testament to how well the Republican gerrymander held up, even in the face of this outpouring of sentiment.
Now, yeah, sure. I mean, they managed to hold some. I mean, the fact that Northam was able to hold and even improve upon Clinton's margins enabled Democrats to break through and, you know, be in a position where they might hold, you know, 50-50 tie in the House of Delegates. But you're definitely right that, you know, if you're under some sort of fair map universe, I think Republicans would do better just naturally because of how concentrated Democratic votes can be. And we, you know, that's been talked about.
Well, better than, better than a completely neutral map.
Sure. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying that, you know, I think on average we'd still expect Republicans to do better on a fair map than, you know, otherwise. But the point is that definitely the Republican gerrymander helps Republicans. Well, there's no question. Yeah.
Listen, let's interject one thing here. And, of course, Sam is doing yeoman's work with Heather Gerken, the dean of the Yale Law School, and trying to push the Supreme Court with a great amicus brief to change the redistricting rules and get rid of some of this gerrymandering. But the greatest
thank you, Larry, for your involvement in that, because you were important there, and I really appreciate.
I wasn't important
enthusiasm
at all, but I was thrilled to sign on. But the point here is Democrats actually gained more in terms of redistricting than they did anywhere else, because now there will be a Democratic governor, Ralph Northam,
yes,
in office at the time of the next redrawing of the lines.
Super important.
U.S. House seats and both houses of the state legislature. In the last redrawing of those lines, we had a Republican governor working with the Republican legislature, and they absolutely minimized Democratic representation, both in Congress, a lower house of Congress, and in both houses of the state legislature. So it is a big step forward for Democrats in Virginia.
Well, Larry, I wanted to broaden the scope a little bit beyond your home state of Virginia. You've been observing politics for so long. I'm intrigued by the fact that, so first off, there's this these things that have happened in last week's election, but I want to broaden out and draw upon your years of experience watching elections. In addition to this sign that we just got last week, there have also been a number of special legislative elections over the course of 2017. And I wanted to hear you talk about the extent to which they say something about what could happen in the future in, say, next year's midterm elections. Do you see it? What's your sense about the overall pattern that we've been seeing this year?
Well, the pattern is very definitely in a Democratic direction. It varies from state to state and district to district. And Democrats have been discouraged to a certain extent because they haven't won as many additional positions as they'd hoped to, and a lot of this stemmed from the Georgia 6 election.
Yeah.
Don Ossoff spent a bloody fortune and still wasn't able to win, though he was able to come very close to winning. I think it's a positive indicator. It certainly doesn't guarantee anything, just like the pattern from last Tuesday is a positive indicator, but it doesn't guarantee that Democrats can retake the U.S. House or win a number of other state legislative posts or capture governorships. But I would certainly rather be in the position Democrats are in than the position Republicans are in. It's true that both parties are split. That often happens. There's some split in each party. But the split in the Republican Party is much more fundamental. and getting nastier by the day because they actually have to govern. And when you have to govern, your decisions have an impact on the factions dominating in your party. Also, President Trump, is there? I don't think there's a learning curve there, from what I can see.
No, he's well saturated.
Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. You know, maybe he'll get better. But if we can take his first 10 plus months as an indicator of what's going to happen in the future, the Republicans are going to have to deal with this all the way through the midterm election, and that means on any given day there are probably 2, 3, 4 controversies that aggravate the divisions in their party or alienate what few independents there are, what few swing voters are left. That's not a good position to be in heading into a midterm.
I guess it's like the saying, people born round don't die square.
That's very good.
Let me just ask, so one last Virginia question. I'd love to hear your perspective, both of you. Was Gillespie and how much President Trump was an anchor. So some thought Gillespie could never be actually a Trump. Others thought that he tried to do it, and that's actually what undercut him a bit. President Trump tweeted out right after the election, Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for. Don't forget, Republicans won 4 out of 4 House seats, and with the economy doing record numbers, we will continue to win even bigger than before. I never know how to read his tweets out loud.
Yeah, so not Trumpy enough.
But that
you weren't
kind
Trumpy
of
question, at all, Julian. Not at all.
That kind of question is a bright. That kind of question is a big one for Republicans. Obviously, they're all going to be thinking about this in the next few months and how to position themselves vis-a-vis the president and his style of politics. Based on Gillespie, Jeff, maybe you can start. Kind of, what's your impression on how he ultimately related to the president, and more importantly, the president's agenda and overall message?
Well, it seems that Gillespie sort of tried to straddle, have his feet on sort of both sides of a line, where on the one hand, you know, he did a lot of messaging on sort of similar to how he did in the 2014 Senate race, talking about the economy, talking about tax cuts. But then on the other side, I think he did embrace some sort of, you know, some Trumpian elements in his campaign. You know, the ads about MS-13 that featured, you know, fairly obvious sort of dog whistle elements in those ads, you know, sort of scary Latino gang members using like a picture from El Salvador from like the 1980s in one of those ads. You know, it was pretty obvious what was going on there. And, you know, it's interesting because there was some polling done. This just seems like a good time to mention it, that, you know, going into the election, a lot of Democrats were scared that this was working. But interestingly, it's possible that Gillespie actually, that those attacks sort of backfired because Latino Decisions, the pollster, actually found some data that suggested that voters were sort of aware that the campaign was being sort of heavily racialized, and that actually angered more voters than it helped for Gillespie in terms of attracting votes. So I would say that to some, you know, the basic question you're asking, to some extent, Gillespie acted fairly Trumpian in terms of the appeals that his campaign was making. Gillespie himself is absolutely not Trumpian. He's, you know, about as establishment Republican as they come. So maybe it was impossible for him to sort of measure up to being Trumpian. But at the same time, he certainly didn't, you know, avoid using some of the same strategy.
Can I ask Larry, turning to New Jersey, you know, our home turf, is there anything useful that could be taken from that election, or is that more predictable as an outcome, both because of the strength of Democrats and obviously the baggage that Christie brought to the Republican ticket, or in from what you're seeing in New Jersey, are there at least some lessons or some evidence about how things might unfold in the next year?
Well, Democrats would be very blessed to have not just an unpopular president, but an unpopular, extremely unpopular incumbent governor, as you had in New Jersey. If we had just had an election for governor in New Jersey and not had Virginia and some of the other smaller races around the country, no doubt Trump would be insisting it was all Christie, because Christie's, last time I checked, his job approval numbers were half of what Trump's are, as poor as Trump's are. So it's more difficult to interpret the New Jersey result, except to say that a clearly blue state voted blue, as you would expect it to do in an early midterm election in a Republican presidency, especially one as controversial as this one. So I tell you one thing that did surprise me, given all the advantages that Murphy had and the tremendous double weight of Christie plus Trump on Guadagno, he only won by a point or so more than Northam won in Virginia, which is a much more two-party competitive state. So that interests me. I don't know whether it indicates that Republicans did a better job of getting out their base vote in New Jersey despite everything, or whether it means that Phil Murphy didn't have the appeal that Ralph Northam ended up having. I'd be interested in your view on that.
Well, I think from the ground here in New Jersey, it appeared that the energy was kind of low because, look, everybody knew who was going to win that election. It wasn't like there was any kind of suspense involved. And I believe I was just reading in Jeff's more recent column that turnout in New Jersey was down by half. Am I reading that correctly, Jeff?
Yeah. Basically, the way we looked at it was turnout in Virginia compared to the presidential election was down roughly like a third, whereas it was down about half
right.
in New Jersey. And the turnout in New Jersey was basically about the same as it was 4 years ago when there was also a really uncompetitive election and well short of what it was in the 2009
yeah.
gubernatorial election in New Jersey.
So, I have this kind of weird contrarian view where I tend to be a little bit blind to exactly who won and lost. You say that the Ossoff thing was a heartbreaker for Democrats, and sure, they lost that one. But my take on this, this is going to sound perhaps kind of odd, but Northam only did about what he should have done in when the president's party is the Republican Party, and so that was only a few points better. The New Jersey thing, it's sort of what was expected. It feels a little bit like par for the course. It strikes me that the overall pattern of special elections across the country, where the average performance on the Democratic side is about 14 points better than the November 2016 outcome, it strikes me that that's the number, whether it's wins or losses. That feels to me like the number that's the most ominous for Republicans. And so, let's now apply it to New Jersey, Does the election say anything about whether Rodney Frelinghuysen is going to be endangered or Leonard Lance? What's going to happen to these guys?
Yeah, I think that's where it gets really interesting, is because those kinds of seats, that are wealthy, affluent, suburban, to some extent, I guess, exurban as well, seats in some parts of New Jersey and around the New York area and then around the Philadelphia area. Those are the types of seats where, in the House of Delegates and thinking about the gubernatorial election in Virginia, we saw Democrats do very well. And those are the kinds of seats I think Democrats are going to have their best shot at winning, especially if there's some more retirement in seats like that.
Right. Well, what about MacArthur?
That's a seat that I believe, Trump did better there than Romney, maybe. Because it is a suburban seat, and that seems to be an area where Democrats can make inroads. But I don't know. MacArthur can also raise a ton of money and come to have some advantage, to be sure. So at this point, who can say? But it's definitely the type of seat that they're going to target.
Well, I think Democrats should target and will target Frank Lobiondo's seat.
Mm-hmm, yep.
That is not too much of a stretch for Democrats. Don't you think?
Yeah, that will be in the crosshairs of Democrats here in New Jersey, that's for sure.
Well, let me ask this big picture. So for someone just reading the news and trying to absorb what Tuesday meant, you'd almost think there is this, head-to-head competition that's going to be taking place between these suburban voters who are angry with what Trump is doing, and they are ready to, vote as vigorously as possible to get some balance in Washington versus the rural voters, the non-college educated voters who are going to hold firm from what I'm hearing or still holding firm in their support of the president. As this plays out in midterm elections, if this is accurate and maybe it's not, how does that play out going into November? Is that simply a turnout issue? Which party can get more people to the polls, or does one side have more influence in a lot of the key House races and Senate races than the other?
I mean, well, you have to separate House and Senate, obviously, because you can't gerrymander the Senate lines. Actually,
you can. That was done 80 years ago when the Dakotas were split.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Or
whatever number of years.
Other examples, but yes. In any event, for the House races, the great advantage that Republicans have is that in so many competitive states, they've managed to get House districts to produce for them in a way that the overall vote should never really produce. Maybe that will change after 2020 because Democrats ought to pick up a minimum of a half dozen governorships, and that means inevitably they will pick up hundreds of additional state legislative posts as well just in 2018. They may get some more in 2020 depending on what's going on presidentially. So I think next time Democrats will have a better shot at fair lines, and that's aside from what the Supreme Court may do in the Wisconsin case. But as for 2018, it's going to be tough. But, you know, Democrats don't want to waste money, and you don't want to put a challenger in a bunch of super red districts where a victory is getting 35% of the vote. It's good for building parties, but it's not good for electing a Democratic majority. But I'll tell you, Democrats need to broaden the list they're working with in the House of Representatives, especially looking at what happened last Tuesday around the country, but particularly in the Virginia House of Delegates election.
You mean recruiting candidates, getting people to run?
Recruiting candidates who not only are good, but are hardworking and enthusiastic, and under the right set of circumstances, could actually surf a wave into shore. It can be done. I never thought some of these Democratic House of Delegates candidates could ever be elected.
Right.
And they did. They got elected. They got elected. They were in the right place at the right time. But they were good nominees. They really worked hard at it day after day, throughout the day. No matter what the odds were against them, they worked very hard, and it paid off. There's a lesson there for Democrats. They do too much election analysis.
Yes.
They really do.
Yep.
And they assume that the past is preface to the future, and it isn't always. So they need to broaden their list of competitive districts or potentially competitive districts, and I would say add at a minimum of 30 or 40 good candidates who might win in a big wave.
I agree. Democrats need to worry less about the green eye shade kind of stuff and just run on principles, run strong candidates. Although, let me ask you one question, though, Larry. Let's put a pin in that and just say, wait a minute, what about Alabama? Doug Jones, there's an honest guy, a rock-ribbed citizen of his state, has done great things. And what? Like, is he going to take down the pedophile or not? What do you think?
I doubt it because Alabama's like the deeply red district I was talking about. You don't want to waste too much money. But this is a special case. It's a special
Let's hope so. Oh, Lord.
And turnout will be driven by intensity.
Yeah.
And the Republican, assuming he lasts all the way to the election, is very vulnerable in ways that most Republicans are not, even in deeply red states. So I'd throw everything in there. And I'll tell you, small contributors are the key there. Across the country, if you made a plea for Democratic donations, it would be like John Ossoff, perhaps bigger. You would get an enormous amount of money, which could help Doug Jones at least at the level that money can help. Now, everything else depends on factors that probably Democrats can't control in that state in particular.
Photographic evidence, that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly.
Or a write-in campaign. I mean, you know, if Luther Strange were to run a write-in campaign, I mean, I think that's where you create a situation where Jones would really have a chance. I mean, that you divide the Republicans in some way. I mean, that might actually do it, but we'll just have to see what happens there. I mean, that still seems unlikely, but you know, we'll see.
I want to see Roy Moore participate in sexual harassment training on Capitol Hill.
Gosh.
Right. Somebody tell him that it's not.
Do those modules that we all do at universities.
Right. It's
right?
Just tell him it's not how to. It's how not to. Someone better.
Yes.
Let me turn the conversation quickly here. I guess one thing I've talked to about with Sam a lot, and I'd love to hear what you guys think. Obviously, the election in 2016 raised all kinds of questions for people about polling and what pollsters might be missing and how to read the data. And you're both at the forefront of political election analysis and prediction. And I'm just curious, have you guys made any adjustments? Are you looking at the data the same way? What's your take, maybe Larry and then Jeff, on the state of election analysis post 2016?
I was concerned when I read Nate Cohn's piece in the New York Times about how pollsters have made surprisingly few changes since last November. Although I must say, the private polling seems to be better, at least the private polling I have access to in campaigns. They're being more careful. The samples almost always now are drawn from voter lists. They have screened their pollsters more carefully. They don't always go for the cheapest offer. They'll pick a pollster who will do a better job. Candidates can't always afford to do that because of the size of their war chest. As far as public polling is concerned, I think we all learned a painful lesson from it, and we're more skeptical than we were. But in the end, what's the alternative? There are some groups developing other measures based on Twitter or Facebook, and I welcome that. I think the more data points we have, the better. The more alternative explanations of what's happening, the better. But I'm not willing to abandon public opinion or public opinion research for methods that don't have a long track record. We'll have to see how well they do. They did okay, by the way, in this set of elections, but I wouldn't say they were spectacular. I understand they're still refining what they're doing. So, you know, my view on that is let's do a lot of it as we saw in 2016, but let's do it better to the extent we can, and maybe in these polling averages, we do need to make some distinction between surveys that are top dollar, that are the gold standard, and the fly-by-night pollsters, because you saw a real clear politics average for Northam. He was up about 3 points. And that's because, in my view, they included a lot of junk polls, really bad partisan polls. So maybe we need to design new methods of averaging polling. Now, some of it's subjective, and I guess that gets you into trouble, and Sam is the expert on that.
Could be some issues with turnout. I think off-year elections especially have bad polling, so it feels like that probably one wouldn't want to overreact too much to the several-point polling error last year, which was obviously consequential, but I think that the bigger concern is midterm elections just are kind of terrible for polling.
So I'm just going to ask you all, and I know Sam looked at this a lot, do you think there is the kind of potential in online polling with very large samples to structure polling to eliminate some of the problems we saw last year?
Yeah, online methods are kind of interesting. The thing that intrigues me the most is the possibility of using very different kinds of information, like using web browsing habits and using web search habits, imputing opinion in a totally different way from just asking people to their face who they'd vote for. Because look, in Wisconsin, Ron Johnson started gaining ground seemingly unexpectedly, but it didn't show up in the final weeks of 2016. But it didn't really show up at the top line race, and it presumably, you know, seems likely that people were reluctant to express support for Trump. Feels like some new kind of information. I've had readers on my website who have run calculations showing that all kinds of information like Google Correlate, where you just look at other patterns of web search, can do a good job of predicting voting behavior. So it feels like other things that measure the kind of thing that you have your finger in the wind, Larry, and you notice voter intensity, that kind of thing doesn't show up in a simple numeric measure like a poll very easily. And so you can get it, but it's hard to get. And it feels like those kinds of supplemental measures might be really helpful in showing at least what the downside risk is, or at least in which direction the downside risk is in polling.
Well, I think I think we need to broaden the methods that we use. And, you know, I welcome all that information. Some of it may be junk, and we'll learn that over time. But something good has to come from last November's catastrophe, and I don't mean just the election of Trump. And so that would be a positive development. I hope that this continues.
Better analytics.
Yeah, voter analytics.
Just to close it up, Larry, I have to ask before we go, what do you think of the JFK file so far?
Well, if you you all are too busy to look at Twitter, but we've been posting documents all yesterday from the very minute that they released the new batch and all day today. Look, here's my summary. Remember, we've covered, I would say 20 to 25% of the total because so much has come out. And a lot of the best documents, they're saving for last because those are the ones the CIA and the FBI are really fighting about. So I don't want to conclude that there's nothing big in there. There may be something big, and we have to be open to the possibility that we'll learn something that will change the basic outline of what we think we know. But based on the thousands of documents we've been through and the follow-up to them, because a lot of times they don't tell you as much as they should, we've gotten some great nuggets, some great details, better explanations for what happened and why it happened. But there's nothing that changes that basic outline of what we think happened before, during, and after November 22nd, 1963. But that doesn't mean that it's not useful. It's very useful. Just take a look at some of the things we put on Twitter. I think you'll be fascinated. And it also reminds people of that deep state that Steve Bannon loves to talk about and other conspiracy theorists do. There is a kind of deep state because there has to be a deep state because of the CIA, the needs of the CIA and the NSA and the FBI. They know a lot. The reason they have fought for so long to keep this private is because a good deal of it embarrasses them. What they missed that they shouldn't have missed that could have prevented the assassination. And also because knowledge is power and they want to have the power. They want to keep the knowledge to themselves. There are a lot of lessons that we could really apply to today.
It's incredible in a lot of the conversations how many people, especially younger people, aren't aware of everything that came out in the church committee hearings in the 70s, which is covered by a lot of the documents in great detail. And it's amazing to me the shock and awe many people have today about some of the stuff the CIA was up to, which obviously our generations all remember. Learning
Operation
about.
Mongoose with Cuba. Right. Who knew they were planning to poison all the crops and starve God knows how many thousands or maybe even millions in Cuba to spark a popular uprising against Castro. And again, it's a warning to us not to get over focused on one particular threat that may not be as much of a threat as we had thought.
That's a great point, and we're gonna have to end it on that. We're out of time, so thanks both to Larry Sabato and Jeffrey Skelly for joining us from Sabato's Crystal Ball, and we enjoyed the conversation very much.
We did too, and we thank you for including us, and good luck with this great podcast.
Thank you. The time flew by. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Larry.
That wraps up our episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.